The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading from The Week magazine this week, dated July 27th, 2012. As usual, we'll begin with the main story section of the magazine. Our first article is Romney Under Pressure Over Tax Returns. Mitt Romney's campaign was left on the defensive this past week after the Obama campaign launched a series of attacks accusing Romney of outsourcing American jobs abroad at the private equity firm Bain Capital, lying about his role at Bain on SEC documents, and hiding the truth about his personal finances. Romney had defended himself against the outsourcing charge by saying he left Bain in 1999, but the Boston Globe reported that Bain filed documents showing Romney receiving a six-figure salary as CEO until 2002. Romney's campaign explained that discrepancy by saying he'd retired retroactively from Bain after leaving to run the Olympics in Salt Lake City. Political pressure for Romney to disclose more than 1 year of his tax returns, meanwhile, intensified when an Obama campaign ad showed Romney singing America the Beautiful while mocking his tax shelters in the Cayman Islands and Bermuda. Despite calls from other Republicans that he release more than his 2010 tax return, Romney said he would not give Democrats more material to pick through, distort, and lie about. Obama's attack ads, he said, were designed to draw voters' attention away from the economy. What does it say about a president whose record is so poor that all he can do in this campaign is attack me? Romney said. Now here's what the editorial said. Romney has some explaining to do, said the New York Times. He himself denied quitting Bain in 1999, back when he needed to prove he was a Massachusetts resident while running for governor in 2002. But now that Bain is accused of outsourcing American workers' jobs to China during that time, he says he wasn't involved. He might clear all this up and the tax shelter questions, too, by releasing Bain records and personal tax returns from this period, yet he has resisted all demands for more disclosure. Why? Romney must bow to the inevitable, said NationalReview.com, and release his tax returns. His current position is unsustainable and allows the president to fight this election over tactics and minutiae when he should be focusing on the economy. Romney's returns are unlikely to reveal anything except his wealth, and voters already know that he's rich. Release them, respond to any attacks they bring, and move on. And now here's what the columnist said. What exactly is Romney hiding, said John Cassidy in NewYorker.com. To conceal his tax returns in the face of so much pressure must be the result of a typical Romney cost-benefit analysis. Since he's paying such a high price for his secrecy, there must be something truly damaging in those returns. My guess, said Joshua Green in BusinessWeek.com, is that Romney lost so much paper wealth when the stock market collapsed in 2008 that he was able to declare an overall loss and pay no federal taxes at all the following year. If true, this would be politically deadly for him. His tax returns are irrelevant, said Daniel Foster in NationalReview.com, and Romney shouldn't cave in to Obama's heckling. Who cares if he has clever accountants? Romney should remind voters of the reams of personal minutiae the IRS demands from American citizens and tell them that when he's president, he'll make the tax code simpler and fairer. You don't win campaigns by playing defense, said Mark Thiessen in the Washington Post. So Romney should go on offense, focusing relentlessly on the president's many failures, especially our moribund economy. With Obama playing dirty, Romney needs to grab a bottle, break it on the bar, and start fighting back. Romney is in real trouble, said Charlie Cook in NationalJournal.com, and counterattacking Obama isn't the answer. His campaign made a critical strategic error in emphasizing Romney's business background while failing to build up its candidate as a real human being, a person voters could like and trust. That has allowed Obama's team to step in and define Romney themselves as a ruthless, tax-dodging plutocrat who lives by different rules than ordinary Americans. That characterization is sticking to Romney like Velcro, and until he does something bold and decisive, he has lost control of the debate. Our next article from the main story section is entitled A Body Blow for Assad's Regime. Syria's 17-month uprising entered a dramatic new phase this week after a rebel bomb attack killed at least three members of President Bashar al-Assad's inner circle, including his brother-in-law and the country's defense minister. The blast at the heavily guarded national security headquarters raised fresh doubts about the government's ability to maintain control of Damascus, which has been rocked by days of continuous fighting between government troops and rebel forces. According to Syrian state television, the dead included Daoud Raja, the defense minister, Asef Shakat, the president's brother-in-law and closest security advisor, and Hassan Turkmani, a senior military aide. Syrian officials blame the explosion on a suicide bomber, possibly a ministerial bodyguard. But the rebel Free Syrian Army claimed that it had planted the bomb and detonated remotely from outside the building. This is the beginning of the end, said James Blitz in the Financial Times. Until now, few high-ranking members of the government have been willing to abandon Assad, mainly because of the violent retribution that the regime pledges against the families of those who defect. But now that the rebels have proved that they can strike at the very core of the command structure, many Assad loyalists may feel they have nothing to lose by switching sides. Assad depended heavily on Raja and Shakat to terrorize anti-regime opponents into submission, said Con Coughlin in telegraph.co.uk. The two officials masterminded the brutal crackdown on protesters over the past year and were also responsible for liaising with Moscow, which has provided invaluable support in helping the Assad regime. Now that these butchers have been eliminated, regime change should be easier to achieve. But this civil war is still far from over, said Hussein Ibish in the DailyBeast.com. The regime may have lost the support of the Sunni majority, but it retains considerable support among Alawites, Christians, and other minorities. Its forces are better armed than the rebels and could still deploy Syria's considerable stockpiles of chemical and other special weapons against sectarian foes. Still, there's little doubt that Assad will eventually fall. The larger question is whether the process will break Syria apart or not. The next article from The Week magazine in the main story section this week is Donor Disclosure Law Thwarted. Senate Republicans this week blocked a bill that would require outside political groups to disclose the names and contributions of campaign donors who give more than $10,000. Two separate votes on the Disclose Act received unanimous support from majority Democrats, but failed to muster the 60 votes necessary to head off a Republican filibuster. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, a Republican from Kentucky, who has argued for full disclosure of donations in the past, called the Disclose Act un-American and an attempt to identify and punish political enemies, or at the very least intimidate others, from participating in the process. With this bill, Democrats are out to silence their opponents, said Bradley Smith in NationalReview.com. Forcing the disclosure of donor lists would allow the Obama campaign and its supporters to harass and publicly vilify anyone who disagreed with their agenda. Spending by pro-democratic labor unions, meanwhile, would remain largely unreported. This is all about Obama losing the money war, said Peter Roth in USNews.com. Only now that Mitt Romney is raking in the cash have campaign contributions suddenly become a problem. Democrats don't want fairness. They just want the GOP's money out of the political process. Republicans were for transparency before they were against it, said Bloomberg.com in an editorial. For years, GOP lawmakers called for disclosure rules, but they've conveniently changed their minds since this Citizens United ruling allowed their corporate backers to spend with abandon. In fact, said John Avlon in the DailyBeast.com, the Supreme Court's controversial 2010 decision promised to balance unlimited money with unprecedented transparency. Instead, we're getting all the hidden cash with none of the sunlight. Enough already with protecting fat cats, said the Washington Post. Don't Republicans see that it is corrosive for democracy for writers of $10 million campaign checks and their motives to remain hidden? Politicians need to curb their lust for contributions and salvage their credibility. We need greater disclosure now before we find ourselves haunted by the secret money of the 2012 campaign. Now from the Week magazine, we'll turn to the controversy of the week. This week it is Penn State. Should it lose football for a year? Throw the book at Penn State, said Joe Nucera in the New York Times. Its former assistant football coach, the convicted child rapist Jerry Sandusky, may spend the rest of his life behind bars, but now it's time for the university that enabled his crimes to pay its own price. Former FBI Director Louis Frey has last week released a damning report that concluded that Penn State officials not only knew about repeated molestation allegations against Sandusky, they heartlessly covered them up for more than a decade in order to avoid the consequences of bad publicity. As a direct result, Sandusky went right on molesting defenseless children. Among those implicated by Freeh's report was legendary head coach Joe Paterno, who went to his grave in January insisting he'd heard only one vague allegation against his former assistant in 2001. Freeh, however, uncovered internal emails and notes that show that Paterno was fully aware of a 1998 molestation allegation against Sandusky and personally intervened after the now infamous shower rape in 2001 to stop athletic director Tim Curley from going to the police. The NCAA can respond to these appalling revelations in only one way, said the Chicago Tribune in an editorial. It must impose the so-called death penalty on Penn State and suspend its football program for at least 1 year. That would be vengeance, not justice, said David Zirin in NYTimes.com. Look, Paterno's reputation has been justly ruined, and his alleged co-conspirators in the university's hierarchy are going to get what's coming to them in a court of law. Financial settlements with Sandusky's many victims may surpass $100 million and will cripple the university for a generation. What good will be served by punishing the 40,000-plus students of the campus in State College, or its blameless new crop of football players and coaches? Consider what's at stake here, said Andy Staples in SportsIllustrated.com. In the sleepy part of Pennsylvania where the university is located, its football games are major events, drawing more than 100,000 fans from miles around. Shutting down Penn State football, even for a year, would put thousands out of work and economically cripple the surrounding region. But it's precisely because Penn State football was so important that this cover-up happened, said Betsy Schindler in the Baltimore Sun. Freeh's report says janitors caught Sandusky performing oral sex on a boy in the showers, but decided not to report it to anyone because, in the words of one janitor, to cross Paterno would have been like going against the President of the United States. Since children were sacrificed for the good of football, the only way to show that one cares more about children now is to sacrifice football. "How is this a close call?" said Dijon Kovacek in the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. "Enabling a child molester's crimes for 14 years is the worst crime any college athletic program has ever committed, far worse than paying players under the table. If football mattered too much then, it shouldn't matter at all now." As Penn State awaits the NCAA ruling on its punishment, it has its own decision to make, said Ta Nehisi Coates in the New York Times. Should it keep or remove the bronze statue of Paterno outside Beaver Stadium? Pressure is growing to clean history and remove the statue, but I say it should remain, along with a plaque explaining how and why Paterno covered up Sandusky's monstrous crimes. It might serve as a warning to all those who elevate sports into a religion and turn coaches into gods. And as you know, this edition of The Week magazine went to press last Thursday, a week before its publication date of July 27th. Since then, there has been an announcement. Penn State has been told that it will be fined $60 million and the Paterno statue has been removed from its outside location and taken inside the building. And we will have more details about that, I am sure, over the next week in the public media and also in The Week magazine. So more to come on that very difficult story. Now, from the controversy of the week to a little lighter item in the news, a good week for and the bad week for in The Week magazine. It was a good week for logging off. After a Swedish study of 4,100 people found that those who never turn off their smartphones and computers are prone to sleeping disorders, depression, and mental illness. It was a good week for New York City Republicans after former Representative Anthony Weiner, the combative Democrat who resigned after a sexting scandal last year, was reported to be mulling a political comeback by running for the city's public advocate job or even mayor. And it was a good week for Truth in Advertising after Ellie Zober, who is 37, of Beaverton, Oregon, listed her home for sale after she divorced her husband. The sign outside her home reads, "Husbands left us for a 22-year-old. House for sale by scorned, slightly bitter, newly single owner." It was a bad week for Krista McCann of Colorado, who loaded up her car with all her possessions and fled the state's Waldo Canyon fire. She crashed while driving through Idaho, and the car caught fire, starting a wildfire that burned about 2,000 acres. It was a bad week for counting your chickens after motorcycle racer Ricardo Russo started celebrating his win in an Italian championship race one lap too early. While pumping his fists in the air, other riders roared past him and he dropped from first place to 14th. And it was a bad week for encores after officials shut off the microphones at Bruce Springsteen's concert in London as he performed Beatles songs with Paul McCartney past the 10:30 p.m. curfew. "We break curfews in every country," E Street Band guitarist Stephen Van Zandt tweeted. "When did England become a police state?" Now we move from good week for bad week for to the People edition of The Week magazine for this week. Our first article, The Pain of Winehouse's Father. Mitch Winehouse still can't believe that his daughter Amy is gone, said Patrick Strudwick in The Independent. The British soul singer died last summer after a long and public struggle with drug and alcohol addiction. She was 27. "I wish it had been me and not my daughter," he says, with eyes bloodshot and glistening. After his daughter's death, Mitch set up in the Amy Winehouse Foundation, which helps drug abusers and underprivileged children. But the charity work hasn't eased his loss. "You can help all the kids all around the world, but it's never going to take that grief away." Mitch has tried other, more unconventional ways of coping with pain. "I've been to spiritualists and mediums, and they've given me great proof that Amy is still here," he said. "Some of the messages we've been given have been incredible, only things I would know, nothing they could have got from the Internet. I sat with a top psychic in America, and I can't remember his name. The FBI uses him on cold cases to help find missing bodies. The first thing he said to me was, 'This is Amy, Dad. There is a life after death.'" Winehouse stops, suddenly aware of how this sounds. "I don't want people to think I'm a deluded fool." The next article, "The Girl Who Escaped Scientology." "Astra Woodcraft's childhood was ruined by Scientology," said Abigail Pesta in the DailyBeast.com. "When she was 7 years old, her family moved from England to Florida to join the C Organization, the church's elite managerial arm. Woodcraft was separated from her parents and lived in a dorm room with other C Org cadets. They received a minimal education. Our teacher spent hours reading to us from Scientology founder L. Ron Hubbard's science fiction book, Battlefield Earth. By age 15, she had been pushed into marriage and charged with enforcing church rules and ethics at Sea Org. Early on in my new job, I had to sit down with a man in his 40s who had admitted to masturbating and tell him to cut it out. She worked 14 hours a day and began suffering from depression. But at age 19, Woodcraft concocted an escape plan. She got pregnant, knowing that the strict rules of Sea Org would require her to have an abortion or leave the church. She quit Scientology, which also meant cutting off contact with her family. It saddens Woodcraft that her mother and ex-husband have no relationship with her now 13-year-old daughter. At the same time, I'm proud to be where I am today. I appreciate my freedom in a way that some people might not be able to imagine." And the next article from the People's section is called "Pop Grows Up." "Iggy Pop is finally acting his age," said Andrew Goldman in the New York Times. 2 years ago, the 65-year-old punk rocker announced that he was giving up stage diving. "I said that after doing a concert for Tibet at Carnegie Hall," says Pop. "His guitarist was playing too darn slow, and I just ran out of ideas, and I thought, well, let's just take a stage dive. Unfortunately, the crowd backed away as Pop leapt off the stage. Nobody caught me because it was the Carnegie Hall Tibetan whatever audience. I was a little miffed," he says. "We've done 2 gigs this year, and I haven't done a stage dive yet. Stages are getting higher and higher, and I'm getting older and older." Still, considering his longtime heroin abuse and various performance-related injuries, Pop is in pretty good shape. "I'm a little bit damaged in about 15 different ways, and it's nice that no particular damaged area has become a major issue. However, he has noticed that his once rampant sex drive has diminished with age. I would characterize it sort of like a powerful interest group with a political party at this point. It used to be the entire political party." And you're listening to our Reading of the Week magazine this week from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Thanks so much for joining me today. We're going to turn to the briefing section right now. The article for this week, Olympic Regrets. With the 2012 Summer Games soon to begin, they begin this weekend, in fact, Londoners aren't sure that hosting them was such a brilliant idea. Well, why did London want the Games? For the same reasons most major cities compete to be selected as Olympic hosts, to attract billions in tourist dollars, to stimulate urban redevelopment, and to bask in the prestige of 3 weeks in the international spotlight. In 2005, when the International Olympic Committee chose Britain's capital over Paris to host the 2012 Games, London was jubilant. Many reckon it is the greatest capital city in the world, then Prime Minister Tony Blair said, and the Olympics will help keep it that way. But with the Games now just days away, many Londoners are feeling anxiety and regret. A recent poll found that half the city's residents are not interested in the Olympics at all, and 42% think the city should never have bid for them. It's a major disaster, said documentary filmmaker Ian Sinclair. You don't need this vast top-down structure spending billions of pounds to obliterate a landscape. Why are Londoners grumbling? Well, they've become acutely conscious of the high cost and monumental inconvenience of hosting a global spectacle. London, a sprawling city of nearly 8 million people, already suffers from congested streets and chronically packed trains and subways, and there's little doubt that extra security measures and a flood of 1 million tourists will tie the city in knots. A recent test on the London Underground and rail lines led to hour-long delays and infuriated passengers. It's going to be like this every bloody day during the Olympics, said one transport worker. The tourists are okay, they're patient, but the commuters aren't. Londoners are also rankled that the game's organizers have designated 250 exclusive traffic lanes on some of London's busiest roads for the use of Olympic VIPs, including executives of sponsors such as Dow Chemical, Coca-Cola, and BP, who also get dibs on all the best seats. But they're particularly worried about the enormous cost of staging the games. How much will it cost? The budget has grown from $3.9 billion when London was selected to $15 billion now. Grim news for a British economy in recession. Every London taxpayer has to pay an annual Olympic levy of $30 and may have to keep paying it for years to cover predicted final expenditures of $19 billion. Late last year, Prime Minister David Cameron doubled the budget for the opening and closing ceremonies to about $125 million, fearing they would otherwise pale in comparison with the extravaganzas produced by Beijing in 2008. And in recent weeks, the costs of keeping the London Games safe have soared. Why is that? G4S, the private contractor hired to oversee security at the Olympic Games, admitted earlier this month that it couldn't hire enough personnel to do the job, even though its contract has expanded from an initial $156 million to $442 million. The government has been forced to mobilize 17,000 army troops to the capital streets, more than the UK currently has deployed in Afghanistan, to deal with the possibility of terrorism. With as many as 50,000 policemen, soldiers, and private security guards swarming the city, Londoners grouse that their city has become a virtual fortress. Warships patrol the Thames, gun-toting soldiers roam train stations and airports, and surface-to-air missile batteries have been installed on the rooftops of residential towers. As a tourist destination, said journalist Simon Jenkins, the place is being put on a par with Baghdad or Kabul. Won't London benefit from the Olympics? The projections say it will. Tourists are expected to spend $3 billion during the event. And the organizing committee says the Olympics are already spurring the redevelopment of East London and will end up creating 11,000 new jobs and 8,000 jobs there. 11,000 new homes and 8,000 jobs. A recent study by Lloyd's TSB estimated that hosting the Olympics could add $24 billion to the UK's gross domestic product. The Games will be a great advertisement for British industry, said Tony Travers, an urban economist at the London School of Economics. This will undoubtedly send a message that Britain is good at delivering big projects on time. What will bring Londoners around? the games themselves, most likely. British Olympic team has greatly improved in recent years, rising from 36th place in the medal count in 1996's Summer Games to the 4th place in 2008, behind China, the U.S., and Russia. This year it hopes to take 4th place again, partly for that reason. Joe Twyman of the polling firm YouGov predicts that Londoners will warm to the Olympics once they get started. The city's residents carped about last year's royal wedding, he says, but now they look on it as a huge success. Complaining during the build-up to large events, he suggests, is a national pastime in a country where world-weary cynicism is the norm and earnest enthusiasm is dismissed as naivete. It's one of those things that you would describe as being British, Twyman said. And now the footnote from this article about the Olympics in London. The last time London was host, Britain is spending less than half as much as China did in 2008 to stage the Olympics, but this year's outlay is lavish compared with the last time London hosted the Games. The entire bill for the 1948 Olympics came to $1.1 million, or around $37 million in today's money. Most events were held in pre-existing facilities, such as Wembley Stadium, and German prisoners of war were pressed into action to build new roads and bridges. The Olympic Village consisted of temporary huts, tents, and borrowed school rooms. Athletes were even asked to bring their own towels. The 1948 London Games actually turned a profit of just under $50,000, the equivalent of over $1 million today. Janie Hampton, author of The Austerity Olympics, says they were probably the most inexpensive, unpretentious, and successful games of the 20th century, setting a challenging precedent for London in the 21st century. Now we'll turn to the best columns in the U.S. according to the Week magazine. Our first column is entitled The Worst Congress in History. Ezra Klein, The Washington Post. And that is a question. The worst Congress in history? The current Congress is one of the very worst Congresses we have ever had, said Ezra Klein. It's incredibly polarized and hideously unpopular, with a 10% approval rating, lower than BP during the Gulf oil spill. And no wonder the House last week voted for the 33rd time to repeal the Affordable Care Act, knowing full well that the Senate would never go along with it. Meanwhile, this 112th Congress has passed less than half the number of laws of any Congress in a half century, sat on key appointments, and failed even to pass a budget. Its inability to act has done serious damage to the recovery, repeatedly spooking markets, consumers, and employers. In 2011, the Republicans' reckless refusal to raise the debt ceiling shook confidence in the nation's solvency, and job growth plummeted from more than 220,000 a month to less than 100,000. The current inability to deal with the coming expiration of the Bush tax cuts is having the same effect. In a less troubled era, such staggering ineptitude might be comical. Given our pressing problems, it is an embarrassment. The next column is entitled, How Obama is Tricking Young Voters. It was written by Rich Lowry in the National Review. Why do most 20-somethings still support President Obama? Asked Rich Lowry. It's certainly not out of self-interest. In 2008, the young swooned for candidate Obama's promises of hope and change, but 4 years later, all they have to show for their support is their childhood bedroom back in their parents' house. His inability to deliver a true economic recovery has been particularly devastating for recent college graduates, half of whom are unemployed or doing poorly paid part-time work. Yet polls show that Obama is leading Mitt Romney by 23% among voters under 30. Apparently, young people are still entranced by Obama's cool and cerebral style. His liberal social views, the slow jam he performed on Jimmy Fallon's talk show. This president seems like their buddy, but in reality, his unwavering support for the entitlement state favors the old over the young. It's the young who will be saddled with the $5 trillion Obama's has added to the national deficit, and who will be stuck paying for the baby boomers' sacrosanct Social Security and Medicare benefits. What dupes these young voters are, they were fooled once, and they will be fooled again. And the next column is Why Romney Spoke at the NAACP by Steve Chapman in the Chicago Tribune. Mitt Romney has no hope of winning over black voters, said Steve Chapman, and yet there he was last week at the NAACP's national convention getting booed for saying he would repeal Obamacare. Why did he go? To woo white voters, not blacks. Simply by showing up at the NAACP, Romney quietly signaled his aversion to bigotry, soothing white suburban moderates whose votes he needs. And by inviting a chorus of boos, Romney simultaneously winked at the conservative base, which loathes the NAACP and duly applauded this rare sighting of the Romney backbone. But Romney is not alone in his criticism. President Obama was also invited to speak to the NAACP, but declined. He knows he can count on more than 90% of the black vote anyway, and in an election year, drawing attention to his complexion is a net liability. Whenever presidential candidates decide to make a speech, in other words, a crass political calculation is involved. Sometimes the people they're addressing are the ones who aren't there. Now in the Week magazine, we will flip to the back of the magazine here for the section entitled The Last Word. This week's article is entitled, Did James Brown Save Boston? Martin Luther King was dead and cities were burning, says R.J. Smith, but the soul singer turned down the heat. A video clip of Martin Luther King Jr. and James Brown standing together in front of the Miami Hilton, King on a step by the hotel entrance, Brown on the sidewalk. Wearing a suit and tie, King drapes his arm around the singer's shoulder, his manner projecting a mellow geniality. He is drawing Brown in. But Brown does not wish to be included. He has a leather overcoat on. He is all but scowling beside King. The Reverend wants to keep talking, but the singer moves away quickly, stops in his tracks, then gets behind the wheel of a big car. He throws the camera a forced smile and then drives off. These two icons knew one another, but they came from radically different places. There were vast cultural differences rooted in family, education, and economic background. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, King believed. Brown was not so sure. Instinctively, the singer responded to obstacles in his path with a display of money and aggression. The idea of a mass movement, of an appeal based on shared beliefs rather than on superior individuality, was not in Brown's makeup. Folks could not be trusted. He talked sometimes about King, but not obsessively, said the Reverend Al Sharpton. He was in one world and lived in it. He respected Dr. King, and he knew that King had given his life. But he did not believe in nonviolence, he always told me, and he felt that Dr. King was not the grassroots guy he was. He respected him, he just didn't see Dr. King as him. In the beginning of April 1968, Brown and his band had returned from their first trip to Africa, having spent 2 days in the Ivory Coast. In New York, they were getting ready to hit the road when reports came that King had been shot in Memphis. As the nation mourned, they were supposed to play a big show, their biggest yet, in Boston the next day. In the late 1960s, the threat of mass racial violence extended beneath the surface of daily life. I am afraid of what lies ahead of us, King said. We could end up with a full-scale race war in this country. The previous summer, there were riots in Detroit, Newark, Tampa, Buffalo, and elsewhere. In Orangeburg, South Carolina, in February 1968, 28 African Americans were injured and 3 killed by police trying to break up a demonstration to integrate a bowling alley. Now it was summer again, and the most important figure in the civil rights movement had just been murdered. The singer was chatting about his African trip on a New York talk show when the broadcast was interrupted by a bulletin that the minister had been shot. Within hours of King's death on April 4, 1968, Brown was giving statements to black radio stations urging listeners not to express their anger by burning down their neighborhoods. Then he pondered the Boston performance. A show had long been booked, but reports of fires and mayhem were streaming in from all around the country. The rage beneath the floorboards was out in the open, and the only question that mattered for politicians and performers alike in the days ahead was how their small gestures might shape larger ones. Unbeknownst to Brown, the managers of the Boston Garden had already planned on canceling his show, operating on the belief that canceling all public events was safer and would keep people off the streets. The event's promoter and a black city councilman warned Mayor Kevin White that this was a terrible idea. Bringing thousands of young African Americans into the heart of downtown and then leaving them there disappointed and angrier than before. How to handle the booking and the crowd with the looming threat of violence was a problem. But even before that was a more immediate question, who was going to explain to the mayor of Boston who James Brown was? That's one marker of how segregated the city was. James Brown was probably the most famous black performer in America, a legend who could fill the biggest venue in town, and the leading white official, Kevin White, had no reason to even know his name. It was decided that the concert should go forward once the mayor was told how many ticket holders were likely to be downtown and that any cancellation would be interpreted as preemptively punishing blacks. Then it was decided at City Hall that the show should be broadcast live on local television, thus giving Bostonians a focus for their grief and a reason to stay home. But a crisis loomed over how to pay Brown for the show. Because if the artist in him felt a responsibility to honor King and to do what he could to avoid bloodshed, the businessman felt a need to see payment for services rendered. The city had just cost him a lot of money. What with the garden seating 14,000, that was 14,000 tickets Brown hoped to sell, and now the mayor was giving fans a way to see the show for free on TV. It was ignoble of Brown not to do the show for free. But it's possible to comprehend Brown's perspective, too. Kevin White kept calling him Jim, pressuring him, telling Brown he owed it to Boston to stick his neck out further than he was willing to. In the end, over a barrel, the city agreed to Brown's $60,000 fee. Then, when the show was over, the city reneged on the agreement, giving him, according to Charles Bobbitt, Brown's most trusted advisor, just $10,000. Where the rest of the money went, we'll never know, said Bobbitt. Brown had bigger worries. There were some African Americans who would attack him as an Uncle Tom for urging his people to sit down instead of protesting King's death, as Brown had figured out before the night began. Should there be violence, now that he was cast as peacemaker, he would receive some of the blame. Did he not implore enough, or did the music stir folks up? He understood how carefully he had to choose his words and gestures. Driving in the bus to the garden, band member Fred Wesley said he was worried he might be shot en route or on stage. Some in the group were praying to just get through things. Others were ready to run. Ultimately, they all went into the deepest show-must-go-on trance. At the beginning of the event, Brown says the hardest words there would be to say all night, "We gotta pay our respects to the late, great, incomparable somebody we love very much, and I have all that admiration in the world for. I got a chance to know him personally, the late, great Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr." Brown brings Mayor White out. He is blinking, groping for air. Like Fred Wesley, he too thought perhaps he could die this night. Brown reads the moment and rushes in, conferring on the white politico his personal stamp, saying, "Just let me say, I had the pleasure of meeting him, and I said, 'Honorable Mayor,' and he said, 'Look, man, just call me Kevin, and look, this is a swinging cat.' Okay, yeah, give him a big round of applause, ladies and gentlemen. He's a swinging cat." The words were perfect in the moment. Brown establishing authority for himself and for the mayor at the same time. "The man is together," raved Brown. This was nonviolent crowd control, and the master of moving audiences had to take things to a new level. There were perhaps only 2,000 people in the garden, but Brown spoke directly to them and adeptly measured the folks watching at home, too. Boston was where all those nights on the Chitlin circuit, learning how to feel what the House desired, how to make thousands rise up and subdue crowds bugging for a brawl, had brought him to. Boston police officers formed a line along the sides of the stage. Then came the most emotional charged moment of the show, the Cape Act, in which Brown performs "Please, Please, Please," a powerful bit of stagecraft in which he goes down on his knees again and again, resembling nothing so much as a shaman going through a ritual of death and resurrection. A group of young fans start pushing past white officers on stage. Bodies rushed in from both sides. Down on one knee, Brown called for "I Can't Stand Myself When You Touch Me," and 1, 3, 5 youths broke through and jumped up, grabbing the singer. The police forced them back, and suddenly, here was the worst possibility: white cops aggressively confronting black youths on live TV. The band went stone-cold silent. The house lights went up. "Let me finish the show," Brown pleaded. "We're all black. Let's respect ourselves. Are we together, or are we ain't?" It worked. "We are," the audience yelled back. He signals the drummer, "Hit the thing, man," and he is back in business. The show continued, and there was no violence in downtown Boston that night. The Boston Garden show has become a major chapter in the telling of Brown's life, and was an even bigger chapter when Brown described it. "I was able to speak to the country during the crisis after the assassination of Dr. King," he said, "and they followed my advice, and that was one of the things that meant most to me." One problem with this formulation is that in the absence of a riot, it is hard to prove that any one or 100 events kept it from happening. In the days after the murder, some 125 American cities experienced upheavals, leaving 46 dead and 2,600 injured. Boston did not, but it's impossible to prove a negative. No riot started, but did James Brown stop one? Indisputably, he kept thousands of angry citizens off the streets that night. News accounts in the days following gave Brown great credit for keeping the peace, and a legend was born. No doubt he recognized Dr. King's inability to quell rioting in Watts in 1965, or to control violence during the Memphis garbage workers' strike in May 1968. King could not stop a riot, but James Brown could. He did it because, he would say later, he loved his country and didn't want to see bad things happen. He did it because he loved his people and thought King's death marked a moment to push forth with his mission, not to ruin it with violence that would be crushed. Though he was hardly a believer in nonviolence, Brown performed the Boston show with King's words in mind. He had sized King up as a sincere man, somebody who believed in what he was saying, and Brown had a Southerner's respect for someone who went the distance for what he believed in. Brown performed that night out of a sense of honor, because it would be wrong to not honor an honest man's memory. Brown's willingness to stick his neck out earned him notice within the White House. In May, he was invited to a Washington state dinner for the Prime Minister of Thailand. When he took his seat, the singer found a note at the table: "Thanks much for what you are doing for your country." Signed, Lyndon Johnson. And that article was from The One by R.J. Smith, published by Gotham Books, part of the Penguin Group, and we read it with permission and all rights reserved. now from the Week magazine, let's take a look at an article from the Health and Science section this week. It's entitled, A Clue to the Cause of Alzheimer's. A rare gene mutation that protects people from getting Alzheimer's could help steer researchers toward drugs that slow the disease's devastating progress. Icelandic researchers tested about 1,795 Icelanders and found that about 1% of them have a genetic variation that slows the formation of the protein beta amyloid, which is known to build up as plaque in the brains of Alzheimer's patients. People with the mutation have 40% less beta amyloid in their brains and are 81% less likely to develop Alzheimer's after age 85 than those without the mutation, the study found. It confers extraordinarily strong protection, neurologist Carrie Stephenson tells Reuters.com. There's little point in testing for the protective variation, which is thought to be present in only 1 in 10,000 North Americans. The finding's real importance is that it shows a crucial link between beta amyloid formation and Alzheimer's, offering encouragement for efforts to develop drugs aimed at stopping the gummy plaque from forming in the hope of preventing or slowing the onset of the disease. This provides some of the strongest evidence ever that amyloid is the right target in Alzheimer's, said researcher Sam Gandy of Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York. Now we'll turn to talking points. Our first article here is TV, the Rise of Binge Viewing. Tech-savvy young people have come up with a whole new way to watch TV, said John Jurgensen in the Wall Street Journal. The binge viewer compulsively views whole seasons of drama series and marathon sessions lasting a day or more using new technologies like on-demand TV, digital video recorders, and streaming websites. Netflix says TV shows now account for 60% of its streaming volume and has even introduced a feature that automatically plays the next episode of a series. TV networks aren't happy because binge viewers bypass advertising vital to their business, but the increasingly popular practice is changing the economics of the industry. Producers now create highly serialized shows hoping to make streaming deals, then invite bingers to devour them in one sitting. Immersing yourself in a well-told TV drama, psychologists say, produces something akin to a trance, making the characters' plot and emotions they evoke seem more real. Binge viewing may be popular, said Jim Pagels in Slate.com, but it destroys much of what is best about TV. Series like AMC's Breaking Bad are intended to be watched over periods of weeks, not hours, and gorging on them denies you a chance to develop a relationship with the characters or to relish each episode as a story in itself. There's nothing quite like the delicious suspense of a cliffhanger, but that pleasure evaporates when you simply click play on the next episode. To me, it's disrespectful to watch the entirety of a nuanced, artful drama in a few couch-buried sittings, said Richard Lawson in TheAtlantic.com. Something like Mad Men, which unfolds with elegant precision and demands a little thinking time, is probably best savored slowly. That's Silly, said James Poniewozik in Time.com. Is a great novel less wonderful if you read it in a long, sustained trance or 20 pages at a time over the course of weeks? That's purely a matter of personal preference. Good storytelling will take whatever viewing conditions you throw at it. Besides, the era of everyone watching TV shows at the same time, the same way, is over, said Linda Holmes in NPR.org. Now you can watch your favorite series on a big TV or on a small TV or on a tablet or on a phone. You can watch it on a train or a bus or in bed in the afternoon or at any time of the day you like. How could that be bad? And now, as we have just a couple of minutes to go before the end of our program, let's take a look at a few short notes that are always interesting. The first one, about 5.85 million adults cannot vote in the November elections because of state laws that prohibit convicted felons from voting, even after they've completed their jail terms. Nearly 8% of blacks are disenfranchised compared with 1.8% of other races, a study by the Sentencing Project found. In Florida, 23% of all blacks are legally prohibited from voting. So far, 0.000063% of the country's population, 196 super wealthy people, have given more than 80% of the super PAC money spent in the presidential election. An incredible statistic, difficult to describe, but it's essentially a tenth of a tenth of a tenth of 1%. They've given 80% of the super PAC money. Quite an interesting observation. The next article, for the first time in history, the U.S. Olympic team will have more female athletes competing than male ones in this summer's games. The 530-strong team is made up of 269 women and 261 men. At the same time a grand jury was hearing evidence in the Jerry Sandusky sex abuse case, Joe Paterno negotiated a new $5.5 million contract with Penn State that gave him a $3 million bonus for retiring and forgave $350,000 in loans. And the average Canadian is now richer than the average American. The net worth of the average Canadian household in 2011 was $363,202, while the average American household had a net worth of $319,970. And now let's take a look at the poll watch for this week. 20% of registered voters say they're less likely to vote for Mitt Romney because of his net worth of more than $200 million. 75% say Romney's income will make no difference in how they cast their vote. And 44% of Americans say they have a great deal or quite a lot of confidence in churches or organized religion. That is a new low, however, and it marks a long decline from the 1970s, when confidence in organized religion was as high as 68%, and that's according to a Gallup poll. We've just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week Magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. Content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. It'll be available as a podcast right after the broadcast on our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long, until next time.